Corinthians chapter 7. Does everyone have a copy of Less Than 7? Do you also need 8 and 9 as well? You don't have those? That's on the back of it. You have 8 and 9? That's the last two. Anybody else need a copy of the material? That's my last one, Dwight. That was my last one, I'm sorry. All right. We'll pick up our discussion from last Sunday on the sins of the flesh, the last group, or the last category in this discussion. We've looked at sins of the heart, sins of the tongue, and now sins of the flesh. And we're looking at fornication, a prevalent sin of the flesh, not just because we see it out in the world, but sadly we even see it too much among Christians. We've been trying to define the words as they appear in the New Testament, so there's a Greek lexicon definition for what this sin is, and it's, when you look at the Greek word, you'll see the origin of our family of words of pornography, pornographic, things of those nature. Galatians 5:19 listed as the sin of the flesh. We were talking about 1 Thessalonians 4, verses 1 through 8. That's a great passage to look at and think about when you consider fornication, where we're taught to possess our vessel, and I think that means our physical bodies, our fleshly bodies, possess them in honor and sanctification. Do not defraud another, I think would lead us to think that Paul was talking about going to bed with someone else other than your spouse. That would be fraudulent behavior. That would defraud another mate's or another person's mate. And it's something that the Lord's going to take vengeance on. We see that in the passage as well. So these four bullet points, if you just read down through this text, this isn't the only four, but these are four good points to think about as you consider that passage. Where we want to start today is 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 through 5. We'll just look at that briefly. One of the more prevalent marriage and divorce and remarriage texts in the New Testament is 1 Corinthians 7, the entire chapter. We won't, of course, look at the entire chapter. Cannot do that in class, nor are we using it this morning sort of as a platform to discuss divorce and remarriage. That's not really our point either. But the first five verses set the tone or set the stage for the discussion Paul gets into about divorce and remarriage. By the way, it emphasizes the importance of marriage in the first five verses. So let's look at these first five verses together. Okay, there we go. The sex drive or the sexual tendencies in man, I've often thought it best to consider them as an appetite. That's really what they are. It's a fleshly appetite, just like it is with hunger and thirst. And so that's put in us by God. We didn't invent that. We didn't find it somewhere and install it on our bodies. That's God given. So the fact that God gave us that drive, desire, it would have been unfair for him to give us that and then not do what? That's right. Provide the way to satisfy that legitimately. And these passages tell us, along with Hebrews 13 and verse 4, tells us exactly where we may satisfy that appetite or that urge in a legitimate way that pleases God. And notice the points that Paul makes here. First five verses of 1 Corinthians 7. This particular chapter begins the whole new section of the 1 Corinthians letter. They had written Paul a letter. And Paul begins to address their questions. That's how verse 1 begins. Now, concerning the things about which you wrote, here's the first subject matter he's going to address, and that's marriage and divorce. it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Now, he doesn't mean that even in marriage, because that would obviously go against what he's about to say in these verses. He means in a general sense, especially, particularly those that one that's not your spouse. But because of immoralities or sexual immoralities, and how does the King James begin verse 2? I think this is interesting. See, to avoid fornication, if we want to avoid this sin of the flesh, Paul says, to avoid fornication, let every man have, that means in the sexual sense, let every man have his own wife, and every woman have her own husband. Let the husband fulfill his duty to the wife, the marriage bed duty, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise also the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Then verse 5. Stop depriving or defraud ye not one another, the old King James says. And really the tense of the Greek is stop depriving. There were some Christians who were already defrauding their mates, going against what Paul has just said in verses 3 and 4. When you get married, then in the sexual sense, your body does not belong to you anymore. It belongs to your spouse to fulfill that duty, that obligation to her that is right and legitimate in marriage. And it's a sin to defraud your mate. Let's just put it that way. It's a sin to do that. It goes against what Paul says. So, stop defrauding, stop depriving each other, verse 5, except by agreement for a time. Now, what do you fill that time with, per Paul here? Fasting and prayer, and one more decision had to be made by mutual consent, that you come back together again. And then here's the reason for the whole thing. Why did that have to be decided that way? Lest what happen? Lest Satan tempt you for your lack of incontinency, the old King James says, or your lack of self-control. Now, trying to be delicate and tactful, I once had to explain this text to a bunch of high schoolers. It wasn't very easy. But to adults who have been married, we know the full force behind what Paul's saying here. So still trying to be tactful, still trying to be delicate about it. Once a person has engaged in the sexual act by God's permission, with God's approval in the marriage relationship, he or she knows full well just how powerful a drive sex can be, correct? They know all about that. Now, all of a sudden, let's say we get this situation where a spouse or a husband or a wife begins to defraud the other mate. It's not right to do that, but let's say that happens. What's going to happen if that keeps going on? Eventually, what's going to happen? It will lead to someone straying off to the bed of adultery because they're continually being defrauded. And that's why Paul said, to avoid fornication, to avoid this sin, let every man have his wife, let every woman have her husband. That's the reason. There's lots of reasons why God gave marriage. Man was lonely in the garden. He needed a help, a mate or a suitable companion, Genesis chapter 2. But here's another reason. It helps us avoid this sin. There's nothing at all dirty or sinful about the sexual union. It's there by God's design. But it is wrong. Hebrews 13 verse 4, marriage is what? It's honorable among all. And the bed undefiled, that is the marriage bed. But then fornicators and adulterers, what's going to happen? God will judge them. That's why it's a sin. So this sin, we know it's so prevalent in our society. But again, we're not here to talk about what's going on out here in the world. We're talking about what's going on mainly within the Lord's kingdom. And how too often we're hearing of saints not being true to their spouses, straying off to the bed of adultery, defrauding their mates, causing all kinds of marriage problems. And this sin would go away among Christians if what would happen? 1 Corinthians 7, verse 5. If we would be true to our mates, not defraud them, not cheat them what is rightfully or legitimately theirs, his or hers, and stay true to our vows. It's a powerful lesson for us. But our culture is dominated by sex and by drugs and by alcohol and all these other sins. And it's just slowly, slowly creeping more and more into the Lord's church. And we've got to fight against that tide. And here's one sin that we can fight against if we pay attention to what Paul says in passages like 1 Corinthians 7. All right. Any other comments on the sin of fornication? Fleshly sin. Disagreements. Agreements. All right. Let's talk now about the sin of stealing. Theft. Stealing. Thayer defines this word as to commit a theft or to take something away by stealth. That is to say, secretly. To steal. Look at Ephesians 4 and verse 28. This comes to mind, to me, one of the more used passages, let's put it that way, with respect to stealing that we'll find in the New Testament. Again, in the context of Ephesians 4, at this juncture, Paul has already been discussing the fact that we had learned to put away some behaviors, and not just behaviors, but also dispositions or attitudes, put them away and then put on the new man. And this is one of them, Ephesians 4, 28. Let him who steals, or let him who stole, steal no more. But rather, let him labor, or work, performing with his own hands what is good, in order that he may have something to share with him who has need. So Paul says there were saints here who were thieves. Obviously, they had been guilty of theft. And Paul says to them, you need to stop your stealing. You need to put that away. And not just stop stealing, but rather to engage yourself in what activity? Honorable labor. That you can provide for what you need, and also do what with what you honorably gain? Share or give. Be thoughtful of others. So stealing thinks of self, doesn't it? What can I get for me by unlawful means? Honorable labor should think of others, based on what Paul says here. Yes, Buford. Yes. 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 I would agree. Buford's point is this passage is not only addressing what we're using it for, but Paul is admonishing us toward honorable labor. To involve ourselves in questionable, or I would even say sinful things, would not be in harmony with this passage, I don't think. God always wants us to labor and to work in things that are honorable and good and wholesome. And that would certainly not allow for choices of work or labor that go against what the New Testament teaches. I would agree with that wholeheartedly, Buford. Look in Titus chapter 2. Titus, the second chapter. These are the things that Paul told Titus to address in his preaching to all groups of people. You read starting in verse 1, these are the things that are fit or proper for sound doctrine, for healthy doctrine. And he addressed at least four groups of people. Older men, older women, younger women. And that catches everybody, as far as I'm concerned. We're all subject to what's taught here. But then starting in verse 9, who does he begin to address? All right, servants or bond slaves, my version has it. So, again, prevalent in the first century was slavery. And it very, very likely that a servant, a slave of someone's property could hear the gospel, obey it. He or she's become a Christian. Well, they still have to go about their duties being a slave, but now they answer to Christ. But listen to what he says. Urge bond slaves, Titus, in your preaching. You urge bond slaves to be subject to their own masters in everything, to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, nor, what, verse 10? Pilfering. Now, what does pilfer mean? Thieving, stealing. That's right. Don't steal from your master. That's not what disciples of Christ do. They don't pilfer, they don't steal. So not pilfering, but showing all good faith. So that what can happen based on verse 10, how it concludes? That they may what? Adorn the doctrine of Christ. See, the doctrine of Christ is like a garment. We're supposed to put it on. So when do you not wear the doctrine of Christ? If you're a Christian. You wear it all the time. There's never a time when you can say, okay, I'm taking a break from wearing the doctrine of Christ. No, it's in every part of our existence, in our work situation, in our family situation, in our pleasure, our recreation, whatever it would be, in our worship, our spiritual thing, our spiritual side of our lives. So these slaves were to not pilfer. Now, let's make some practical applications. How may present day saints be guilty of pilfering? We're not slaves in that sense, because that's not part of our culture. But for all intents and purposes, could we not be guilty of pilfering? Okay, you could steal company time. That's more of an intangible thing, but I would agree that would be just as serious. Your company that you work for has agreed to pay you a certain amount of wage for work. What if you don't work? Well, aren't you pilfering? Stealing? How about taking office supplies home? I don't mean to be too picky here, but I mean, let's just get right down to the nitty-gritty of it. You can steal things from the company. Well, a pen here, a notepad of paper there, or stationery here, or whatever it might be. Maybe a computer. I don't know what you'd steal, but we can be guilty of this same kind of sin. And Christians, we don't do that. We don't steal. If we want something, we have to go out and honorably labor for it, get paid for it, and then we can go purchase it. We don't have to steal. We shouldn't have to steal. So saints need to be mindful of these things. Notice also, I've got on the chart here, John 12 and verse 6, and we looked at this earlier when we looked at sins of the heart, one of which was greed. Again, who's described in John chapter 12 and verse 6? Judas. And we made mention back there that he had the quote-unquote job, the task, the duty of being the treasurer for the disciples. He carried the money box. And I don't think my opinion is they probably wouldn't have a whole lot, but whatever they had, he kept it. Well, he was the wrong person to keep it. Why is that? He would on occasion get his hand in the till, and he would take. So he was a thief. And what I'm saying here is, as we said back there, one sin will often lead to another. And what needs to be emphasized is that which came first, the sin of greed or the sin of theft? Greed came first. And whatever's in the heart, actions always follow thoughts. Actions always follow attitudes. So if we have the sin of greed in our hearts, Judas is the example here, then what's going to happen to a greedy person when presented the opportunity to take something by stealth or by theft? More than likely, and I'm not saying it's absolute, but I would say more than likely, he'll find the opportunity and he'll seize that and take something that doesn't really belong to him because he's a greedy person. And we see that in the case of Judas Iscariot. Okay. Finally on this list, we looked at the sin of drinking. I think it's important for Christians to talk about that. Just as disappointing to have to talk about fornication among Christians is just to talk about drinking among Christians. And I wish that wasn't so. But I've talked to brethren who defend drinking. Maybe you have too. And I wish that wasn't so. But I have. So we need to talk about this. Look back in Galatians 5 and verse 21. Back to that list, if you will. The sins or the works of the flesh. The deeds of the flesh. Those sinful things. Galatians 5. Deeds of the flesh are evident or made manifest, verse 19. The first category talked about is those of a sexual nature, immorality, sensuality, impurity, then idolatry, witchcraft or sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, so forth. Verse 21, drunkenness. This would be, as I've got on the chart here, out and out drunkenness, just drunk. But not just drunkenness. What's the next word listed in verse 21 after drunkenness? Revelries? Any other versions? I've got carousings in mind. Carousings or revelries. Now, if you look that word up, that's being half drunk. Yes, that's the fellow who's the life of the party now. Everything's funny. He's got the lampshade on his head, and he's just yucking it up at the party. He's not out and out drunk, but he's half drunk. That's what that word means. Well, not quite there. We're going to get there, Brother Thomas. You're correct. But this passage, I don't believe, addresses social drinking. But at least these two, drunkenness and half-drunkenness. But now we come to 1 Peter 4, where Dwayne was going. So let's go to 1 Peter 4. And I believe we'll see there's one more category of drinking that I can say. I have no qualms saying this or preaching this. I believe social drinking is sinful. I believe it is. Now, we got brethren that defend that, but I believe they're wrong about that. 1 Peter 4, just start in verse 3. We'll read through verse 5. The time already is past, or the time already past is sufficient for you. Enough time has passed by for you to have carried out the desire of the Gentiles. Having pursued a course of sensuality, there's some sexual sins again, sensuality, lusts. Now, the next word is drunkenness. That's the same as in Galatians 5, out and out drunk. The next word is revelries or carousals, carousings. Again, same as Galatians 5 and verse 21. Then the Old King James has next the word banquetings, correct? What's the New King James say? Drinking parties. That's social drinking. That's the cocktail sipping. That's the wine sipping. That's like going to the office party and having an occasional cocktail here or there. No one's drunk. No one's laying out on the floor. No one's even half drunk. Lighthearted. It's just drinking parties is the cocktail sipping. So out and out drunkenness, half drunkenness, and even social drinking, we call it, is condemned in this passage. Already enough time to have done that. And abominable idolatries. And in all this, that is, they who practice these things, verse 4, they're surprised that you do not run with them, that you don't participate with them to the same excess of dissipation. You ever get made fun of because you don't go to an office party? And they speak evil of you. Isn't that how verse 4 concludes? They malign you. They'll speak evil of you. But see, what's our main concern? That someone's going to speak bad about us, or verse 5? What's out there that we're conscious of? God's going to judge behavior like this. And we care more about the fact that God does not approve of that rather than other people who make fun of us and poke and who ridicule us and chide us for not going to a drinking party or not going to an office party where drinking occurs. So I believe based on 1 Peter 4, that's the passage that really condemns social drinking. And I have no qualms saying that. Yes, Justin. They will. If your heart is right, you'll avoid those situations. You're correct. You want nothing to do with those. Now, does that mean, well, I'm not tempted by that? Well, I'm glad for that. But why even go to those settings? Why even participate in those in those activities when you know it's something that the Lord does not approve of? Have you ever been told, well, if you don't, you're expected to be there. Your boss tells you, you've got to be there. Well, I was told that one time, and I didn't go. I didn't lose my job. I got reprimanded, but I didn't go because it just was important to me to do what the Lord said here in this passage. So pressure sometimes is brought to bear against Christians for not going along with those kinds of activities. Now, very familiar passage in the Proverbs. It's well known what the Proverb writer says. Right, let's turn to Proverbs 23 and let's read this together. Just asking the general question, what praiseworthy thing, anything praiseworthy that comes from alcohol, from drinking? I can't think of a one. David Steele, would you read for us, please, these familiar verses? Proverbs 23, starting in verse 29, and read for us through verse 35, the end of the chapter. Look at these rhetorical questions at the start of the text where I had David read. Who has all those things? Verse 30 has the answer. Who does? Those who linger over alcoholic drink. Who linger long over the wine. Verse 31, can it look appealing? Can it seem appealing? Yes, but what does the writer tell us at the end of verse 31, end of verse 32? It'll bite you like an asp or an adder, a poisonous, venomous a serpent. Stings like a viper. Verse 33, what will it do to your body? What will it do to your physical senses? Makes you see things, right? Your eyes will see strange things and your mind will utter perverse things. You lose your sobriety. How often can we find in the New Testament that we're to be sober people? And that just doesn't mean free from alcohol. I mean, to be sober means to be sane. It means to be serious-minded. We take our Christianity seriously. We take all of our obligations in this life seriously. Well, what happens if I linger long over the cup and if I drink? Then what's happened to my seriousness? It's gone. I'm not going to be a serious-minded person. Verse 34, you'll be like the one who lies down in the middle of the sea, or like the one who lies down on the top of a mast. Very figurative language. You'll say things like, they struck me, but I did not become ill. A person who drinks has too inflated a view of himself. I'm in no danger. They struck me, I did not become ill. They beat me, and I did not know it. When shall I awake? Well, some people, when they awake, what's the first thing they think of? Let's have another one. That's where the chapter concludes. I will seek another drink. So nothing praiseworthy comes from this. Yes. It's an addiction. And though the Scripture here is not talking about other sins, it's talking about drinking, but we could apply the same kind of thinking to other behaviors where we become addicted. Drug use, tobacco, it's an addiction. These are all things that's harmful to the body. And so we're dealing though with this sin, the sin of drinking. So that's a sin of the flesh. Okay. So it seems to me the only decision, the only spiritually, well, I left a word out there, the only spiritually safe way, I should say, to serve God regarding alcohol is total abstinence. We stay away from it. Now, I know you've heard the arguments, I have too. What about John chapter 2? Jesus made wine at the wedding feast of Cana. Well, we could have that discussion. Or Paul told Timothy to do what? Take a little wine for your stomach's sake. We could have that discussion too. But I believe to use those passages and use them in defending social drinking, I think, is perverting those passages. That is not what the Lord did, and that's not what Paul would have in mind for us to do with those particular texts. But that could be another discussion if that need to be held sometime. All right. Anything else on the sin of drinking? Sin of the flesh. Okay. Let's turn now to page 19. And again, I realize that those lists were very short in terms of using them as an example. There's many, many other sins that we could look at. But that was enough to make our point that sins can be in the heart, they can be on the tongue, they can be fleshly sins, where they're satisfying carnal or fleshly appetites. What I'm going to do now is talk about the next lesson, which is reacting to sin. Many other points could be made about it, but when it comes down to it, and we've discussed some of these things off and on throughout the quarter, and we only have four classes left after today, and the quarter's over. But when it comes down to it, all of us are going to have to react to our sin. We're going to have to react to it because of passages like Romans 3:23 that says what? All have sinned. There's not a person among us who can say, well, this doesn't affect me. All have sinned. Then John's two statements in the first chapter of his first letter. If we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves, and the truth is not in us. And then verse 10 says, if we say we have not sinned, we make Him a liar. That is God. We make God a liar, and His Word is not in us. Why would us saying, I have not sinned, make God a liar? Because what did He say right there? You have sinned. Yes, you have. All of us have sinned. So we don't want to get ourselves in a position where we're calling God a liar. No, you're just wrong about that, God. That doesn't describe me. So rather than play games of sophistry where we just start playing word games with God and all these kinds of shenanigans, no, we're going to have to face our sin. Whatever the sin is, we're going to have to face it and deal with it, and we're going to have to react to it. So this is the point of this lesson, and I just chose two examples. I want to focus on two men, both from the Old Testament, and their lives were intertwined. And it's a great contrast of how one reacted versus how the other reacted. The first man is who? King Saul. We'll talk about him. So turn to 1 Samuel chapter 15. These are well-known statements. We've looked at a few of these just quickly in passing in previous classes. Now we'll devote a little more time to what's going on here. Saul is the first character here. One's failure, the first man's failure, led to the second man's success. So Saul, to me, was the failure. Saul showed, I believe, and we'll use this as question four when we get to it, he showed three bad reactions to sin, to his sin. He reacted badly in three different ways. And the success of the other, well, of course, that's going to be David. And David reacted in a good way. Now, initially, how did David react? Well, not good. But we've already been through that that part of the story in a previous lesson. So I'm going to skip that and get to David's good reaction. So we got Saul, how he reacted, and David, how he reacted. And then what you and I have to do is look at this and say, all right, which one am I going to do? How am I going to react when I sin? And that's the focus for this particular lesson. So let's first talk about Saul's bad reactions. And this starts the questions now. All right. So in 1 Samuel 15, who's the prophet that's God's mouthpiece here? All right, Samuel. And he dispatches Samuel to the king, and he has instructions for him. Verses 2 and 3. All right, Rob, read for us, please. 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 through 3.
Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he ambushed him on the way when he came up from Egypt. Now go and attack Amalek and utterly destroy all that they have, and do not spare them.
Okay, so God had instructions for Saul. You go to Amalek, you strike him down. How many were to be left as survivors? None. What about the livestock? None. I want them utterly blotted out. Now, that's not hard to understand, is it? That's just, you just go in there and mow them down. That's basically what you're supposed to do. The reason for this command from God appears to be based on revenge. Now, that sounds bad, but for God to exact His revenge is not a bad thing. Romans 12, verse 19, what did Paul quote? Vengeance is mine. God has revenge. I will repay, says the Lord. Now, what would be the reason for this destructive behavior from Saul to be enacted toward Amalek? Why would God make this command? All right, yeah, look in verse 2. I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way while he was coming up from Egypt. If you turn back and read Exodus 17, verses 8 through 16, it's one of the more familiar Old Testament stories. How did that battle get fought that day? Do you remember how the story went? There's three men involved. Well, Joshua was told, he was the general, take the army out there and strike Amalek. But then three other men were involved. Moses, Aaron, and Hur. H-U-R, Hur. And how was it that the battle tide would sway one way or the other? Remember the story? Moses would hold his hands up. And when Moses' hands were up, Israel prevailed, the text says. And when Moses got tired and his hands dropped or drooped, then Amalek would prevail. So it was going back and forth. And so here were Aaron and Hur at Moses' side up there. And so they gave Moses a rock to sit on. And then what did they do? Remember this? We've always heard this phrase about a preacher, hold his hands up. That's where you get that. They would hold Moses. They held Moses' hands up all day long. And what happened? Israel won that battle. Now that was the battle that took place. But we're going to just read one or two statements here. We won't read that part of it because that's just easily understood. Drop in at verse 14. At verse 13, by this time Joshua has overwhelmed them because Aaron and Hur held Moses' hands up. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this in a book as a memorial and recite it to Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. Now notice, that's future tense. They just had the battle. Amalek was defeated. Yet he still says, write it in the book, I will blot out Amalek. When's that going to take place? 1 Samuel 15. God said, I'll take care of Amalek. Earlier in the text, you'll see at verse 8, they came out and fought against Israel. And so when he says back here through Samuel to King Saul, verse 2, I'm going to punish Amalek for what he did to my people when they came out of Egypt. Now's the time for that reckoning. Anybody want to guess how long it's been since Exodus 17? At least 400 years, Bernie, you're correct. Over, you got the 350 years of judges, all right? You got the 40 years of wandering, because when we're in Exodus 17, we haven't come to Numbers 13 and 14 yet, where you have the 40 years of wandering. Then you have a few years, but it took Joshua to divide up the land of Canaan once they did go in. So it's at least close to, if not a little more than 400 years. What's that tell you about God's purpose? He's got a good memory. Nothing dissuades God. When God sets His mind toward something, even the long passage of time does not deter Him. In fact, what does Peter tell us in 2 Peter 3? With the Lord, a day is as 1,000 years. God doesn't operate on time like we do. That just means nothing to Him. If He wills that something needs to be done, if it's 1 year or 4,000 years, that makes no difference to Him. He sees something's going to have to be taken care of, and He takes care of it. So, that was the instruction that Samuel gave to the king. This came from God. Now, look in verses 7 through 8, back in 1 Samuel 15. All right, so the text says, well, Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt. And he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people, this is verse 9, spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless they utterly destroyed. All right, so there was a great slaughter, and the people were cut down. But already, starting in verse 7, where do you see some problems? Who's mentioned specifically? I'm sorry, that should be verse 8. Pardon me. First part of verse 8. Agag was spared. Well, did he not fall under the judgment of God's words back in verse 3? Where did he say, kill the people, but you can spare the king? He never said spare the king. He said, kill everybody. King's a somebody. So he spared the king, captured the king, and killed the people. Regarding the animals, verse 9, what decision was made regarding the animals? All right, so we got the spoils now of the livestock. Well, let's look them over. All right, we got these animals here, and there's some good ones and there's some bad ones. So those bad ones are not worth anything anyway. Let's kill them, but we'll keep the good ones. Again, what do you have? It's a transgression of what God said. All right, we'll pick up our train of thought here. This will put us, Lord willing, on Wednesday night, question 3. And then we'll complete Saul's story, and then we'll get to David on page 20. Thank you for your participation and your good comments.